Hello. It's April 12th, 2025. My name is Simone, and this is 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to this brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. Like always, I hope you all have had a great week so far and are having a good start to your weekend. I will go ahead and let you know that today's case is going to be shorter than other episodes, as I don't have that much information as I'd like on the case. But I wanted to bring it to you anyway, as well as there will be some aspects of domestic violence in the case as well. And with that, let's dive in to today's case. The year was 1994. And in the smaller southern city of Gadsden, Alabama, with a population of around 38,000 around this time, most of the people who lived there loved the city's southern charm with a close-knit community vibe. Residents also here enjoyed traditional southern pastimes like hunting, fishing, and spending time with family. And many flocked to Gadsden's downtown area, even though reports state that the area saw some economic and aesthetic decline by this time. But many families still had fun by going to local diners, parks, high school football games, and community events. Also around this time, Gadsden was primarily known for its manufacturing industry, with companies like Goodyear Tire and Rubber, which had a large plant in the area, being a significant employer. As a matter of fact, the city had a history of iron and steel production, given its industrial heritage. However, like many cities in the region, Gadsden faced economic challenges as manufacturing began to decline in the 90s due to outsourcing and automation. This shift led a noticeable impact on the local economy, though Gadsden remained an important hub for jobs in the area. Many in Gadsden suffered financially, and reports state crimes like assaults and robberies began to rise. But even though crime was rising during this time, what most in Gadsden weren't prepared to learn about was a robbery that occurred here in 1994 that was bloody and brutal. And it would leave the city on edge and wonder if justice would ever be served. In the following case, you'll find out what horrific crime occurred here, the investigation, and the shocking aftermath in a case I title, Blood on the Menu. On the night of April 15, 1994, at the Popeye's Chicken Restaurant, located on the east side of Gadsden, Alabama, business was said to have carried on as usual. And when the restaurant closed at 11 p.m., working the shift was Tamika Collins, assistant manager Daryl Collier, Nathaniel Baker, and Bryant Archer. Reports state that after closing, Bryant helped Nathaniel gather trash to take back to the dumpster, and Daryl unlocked the back door to let them out to the back. But what they didn't know was that two men were standing on the other side, and when the group of men came across them, all hell broke loose.
Let's go ahead and get on the corners. Let's go to the corners. Go to the corners. Go, 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 go. I got your back, babe.
Something. We got three over here.
Three rescue.
Back.
Back.
won't help you, okay?
I need some blood. I don't have blood.
We know. You're going to be okay.
You're going to be fine.
Lay still, Brian.
Okay.
Where do you go to school at?
Gadsden High.
Gadsden High? Well, you hold on, partner. You play ball or anything? You one of the smart ones. Good deal, good deal.
Okay.
Us dumb guys play ball.
Yes,
real slippery. Just hold on for us, okay? You're going to be all right.
No, he's talking bad.
No, I didn't know. You're going to be okay, babe.
Yeah,
you.
Get right here. Get right here, okay?
You're gonna be all right, Brian.
Pull by. Let me see if I can find anywhere else real quick. How you doing? Oh, baby, baby, baby.
Just hang on, partner.
According to reports, after the three male employees headed out the back, the two men on the other side of the back door rushed them with guns and ordered them, as well as Tamika, to go toward the back of the store, and ordered them to give them money from the restaurant safe. When the workers complied and the money was given to them, it wasn't enough, as the assailants then ordered the group to the restaurant's freezer, and then they were locked inside. And then, according to reports, one of the assailants unlocked the freezer and opened fire on the workers, shooting them all in their heads, before he and the other assailant fled back out the door. A while after they left, injured worker Bryant, who had been shot in his head, neck, chest, and jaw, made his way out of the freezer and crawled to the phone to call for help with all his might. After emergency personnel arrived, they quickly tended to Brian, and while paramedics were getting ready to transport him to the hospital, police questioned him about what happened. According to reports, Bryant told officers that after Daryl unlocked the door for him and Nathaniel to take out the trash, the two men, who he said one was black and the other Hispanic, rushed them, pointed guns at them, and ordered them to give them money. Then, like previously mentioned, they were all still gunned down while being held hostage in the freezer. Bryant also added that despite the men both wearing bandanas, he was sure he recognized the Hispanic suspect as a former employee of Popeyes due to his unique hairstyle, but he wasn't sure about the black suspect. He added that it was the black suspect who told the workers to get in the freezer, locked it, unlocked it, and then shoot them. Lastly, just before being transported to the hospital, Bryant said the Hispanic suspect was his former coworker, Cuauhtemoc Peralta, and that although he didn't see the car the assailants arrived in, he knew Cuauhtemoc drove an older black Monte Carlo. After his interview, police issued a BOLO, or be on the lookout, alert for a black male and Hispanic male driving an older model black Monte Carlo to officers in the city and surrounding areas. But back at Popeyes, paramedics determined Tamika, Nathaniel, and Daryl were beyond help, and they were pronounced dead at the scene. After the BOLO was released, reports state an officer from nearby Rainbow City, Alabama, heard the announcement and realized the description of the Hispanic suspect also sounded like someone he knew as well in their small town. Cuauhtemoc, and he knew where he lived and paid him a visit. According to reports, when the officer arrived at Cuauhtemoc's home, he noticed activity going on inside as he pulled up. He also saw the suspected Monte Carlo in the driveway, and after a while, the officer noticed Cuauhtemoc and another man leave the home and get into the Monte Carlo. The officer followed the car and then eventually pulled the car over. Reports state that after the traffic stop, the officer noticed Quantumak was in the passenger seat and a black male was driving, and he was later identified as 22-year-old Robert Milson. According to reports, Robert Milson was born Robert Bryant Milson on June 5, 1971, in Gadsden, to Robert and Geraldine Milson. He had an elder sister and younger brother, but reports state Robert's home life as a child was anything but peaceful. You see, Robert's father, Robert, served in the Vietnam War, and when he came back home, due to what he saw on the battlefield, he developed PTSD and other mental issues to cope. He developed an alcohol addiction as well, and even worse, reports state that Robert was an angry alcoholic and took out his anger on his family frequently, and his addiction squandered the household money, and they had so little money that Geraldine reported to social services that the family had no money for food. Reports also state that eventually Robert's father left the home, but when he would see Geraldine, he would abuse her in front of the children, and it kept going until Robert's grandmother threatened him with a gun, and then he abandoned the family altogether. Geraldine divorced Robert Sr. and then married another man named Alvin St. George. But if she thought this marriage would be any better, she would be wrong. This was because Alvin was a seasoned drug dealer and he could be violent with anyone, and that included Geraldine and her children. Geraldine herself eventually got addicted to drugs, and reports state their home was frequented by fellow users, with one allegedly giving Robert Jr. his first drug when he was 8. Robert and his siblings by this point dealt with so much turmoil in the home that they frequently spent time at their grandparents' house across the street. And they even wanted to move in with them, but they were very elderly by this time and could not let them. Due to this, Robert tried his best to stay away from Geraldine and Alvin by staying with other family members and at friends' homes. But his world would be turned upside down by 1983, when on May 8th of that year, Geraldine was murdered. According to reports, May 1st, 1983, was the last time Geraldine's family heard from her, when she called her mother that day to tell her she was in a neighboring city and that she was running away from Alvin. And then, 7 days later on the 8th, she was found in the front yard of an abandoned house in Gadsden. Reports state that Geraldine had been beaten, but she was unconscious, yet alive, when she was found. But she later died in the hospital. It was believed that Alvin was behind her murder, but due to a possible lack of evidence, Geraldine's murder went unsolved. After her murder, Robert and his siblings were sent to live with their uncle in town. Reports state the siblings did well here, as their uncle was strict and structured. But the siblings decided they wanted to move in with their other set of grandparents, as there were not too many rules, because they were elderly, and they could pretty much do what they wanted. Curiously though, when the children went to live with their other grandparents, they seemed to be happier, especially Robert, because reports state he became a good student and athlete, and was actively involved in his church. However, possibly due to his trauma growing up, Robert spiraled and dropped out of high school, and then began his life of crime. Reports state that shortly after dropping out, he broke into a wildlife store to try to commit robbery, possibly. But he was caught by a passerby and was arrested. He was sentenced in May 1991, and although Robert had no prior criminal record, the court denied youthful offender status, and he was sentenced to 7 years. He was granted early release in 1993, but out of prison, he was illiterate for the most part and struggled to find work as a convicted felon. Due to this, Robert began to sell drugs to support himself in the housing projects of East Gadsden. And over the years, leading into 1994, reports state Robert racked up 3 felony convictions, continued to sell, and continued to hang around the wrong people who also lived in the crime world, including 17-year-old Cuauhtemoc Peralta. According to reports, Cuauhtemoc, just like Robert, did not grow up in the best circumstances. Reports state that when he was just an infant, he suffered domestic abuse from his father, who, like Robert's father, was an alcoholic, and beat him even as a baby when he would cry or when he wouldn't play and giggle. He also abused Cuauhtemoc's mother, Loretta, and siblings, and reports state that when Cuauhtemoc was 18 months old, his mother had enough of his abuse and shot and killed him. Loretta was sentenced to time in prison, along with her mother, sister, and brother-in-law. And due to his parents' absence, Cuauhtemoc was shuffled around by different family members to look after him and his siblings. After Loretta was released in 1984, she tried to raise Cuauhtemoc and his siblings to the best of her ability. But she had very little money and was homeless, and she and her children lived in her car for a while. Loretta eventually got a job as a truck driver, and Cuauhtemoc traveled with her a lot, meaning he rarely went to school or had friends. But when he did, he got in trouble due to anger issues. He, like Robert, eventually ventured out on his own and dropped out of high school at a very young age, and also racked up a criminal record. Reports state his first charge was a robbery, in which he spent 3 months in juvenile detention. Then he received a charge for car theft in Nevada, to which he was sentenced to time served in a youth boot camp. Eventually, Loretta moved to Gadsden, presumably for work, and Cuauhtemoc followed her there in 1993 with his 2 brothers. And it's not clear when, but eventually, sometime after he moved to Gadsden, he met Robert Melson. Reports state the two hung out around each other a lot, allegedly sold drugs together, and dabbled in all sorts of crimes. Until one day, Cuauhtemoc came up with the idea to rob where his ex-girlfriend worked and where he once worked before he was fired, which was Popeyes. According to reports, after the shooting, Robert and Cuauhtemoc were arrested by Rainbow City Police and then transferred to Gadsden. Reports state, while interrogated by Gadsden Police, Robert maintained that he and Cuauhtemoc had been together all night on the evening of April 15th, 1994, and that they were only separated when they were pulled over by the police in Rainbow City and arrested at around 1:20 a.m. on April 16th. Robert told the police that they had been driving around smoking marijuana and that they had driven by Popeyes several times that evening, but they had not gone inside the restaurant. He further told the police that he and Quatermach had gotten their clothes wet that evening and that they had gone to Quatermach's house to change clothes. However, a few days later on April 18th, Robert asked to speak again to the investigating officer. And he gave a second statement at that time in which he stated that Quatermach had picked him up at 4 p.m. on April 15th and that the two of them had driven around in Quatermach's car, smoked weed, and then he said at 11:50 p.m., Quatermach told him that he was going to visit his ex-girlfriend who worked at Popeyes. Robert continued and said that after Quatermach told him his plans, he asked Quatermach to drop him off at a housing project, and that he walked around the housing project until around 1 a.m., when Quatermach picked him up. Lastly, Robert said that Quatermach asked him to drive and that Robert saw the police cars and ambulances at Popeyes. According to Robert, Quatermach tried to tell him what he had done, but Robert said that he did not want to know. Then Robert said, again, that he and Quatermach went to Quatermach's house to change their clothes because it had been raining that night and their clothes had gotten wet. Quatermach, on the other hand, took responsibility for his part in the crime and stated he bought the gun used in the crime for $129, that he bought the gun to rob people, and that he came up with the idea to rob Popeyes because he knew what money they had. He then told detectives that on the night of the murders, he and Robert parked in a nearby neighborhood behind Popeyes. And when it was time to execute their plan, they ambushed Bryant, Nathaniel, and Daryl, and that he remembered specifically pointing a gun at Tamika and saying, quote-unquote, "This ain't no joke." Quatermach continued and said that after they made off with around $2,000, Robert came up with the idea to put the workers in the freezer and shoot them. And Robert was the one to kill them all, except for Bryant. Lastly, Quatermach said they fled after the shooting through a drainage ditch to his car, and that's how they became wet, and then discarded the gun in the nearby Coosa River. After both interrogations, both Robert Melson and Quatermach Peralta were charged with 3 counts of capital murder, 1 count of attempted murder, and 1 count of robbery. At both trials, the forensic examiner testified that 18-year-old Tamika Collins, who was a community college student, was killed by a gunshot wound to her head. 17-year-old Nathaniel Baker, who was studying to become a carpenter, died from wounds to his neck and head. And 23-year-old Daryl Collier, assistant manager and father to an infant, died by a shot to his face and his spinal cord was severed. Quatermach's mother, Loretta, also testified at his trial about his rough upbringing in hopes that he'd get leniency. But in 1996, Quatermach Peralta was found guilty and sentenced to life without parole at the age of 18. Also, in 1996, Robert was found guilty of capital murder and was later sentenced to death. After his death sentence, many argued in his favor that there wasn't enough DNA evidence to link Robert to the crime. But despite several appeals and stays of execution, Robert Melson was executed on June 8, 2017, at the age of 46. Meanwhile, after Quattlemoc's conviction, reports state in 1999, while serving his life sentence, he killed a fellow inmate, and in 2001, he was sentenced to death and is currently still on death row. The story of the 1994 Gadsden Popeyes massacre comes from the sources of the Birmingham News, USA Today, Alabama.com, and others I'll put in the notes. All right, I'm going to do a very, very, very short opinion piece, like a few sentences. I'll say first, rest in peace to all the victims. Their lives were taken, their young lives were taken by foolishness, by robbery. My thing is, they took the money before they even killed the victims. And I just wonder if that was just a thrill killing as well. Like, I wonder if, or they panicked or realized, you know, maybe Robert, who some people think he didn't kill the people, but he was found guilty, so I will say he did kill them. There was no DNA. There's also DNA of his apparently matched to the scene, and DNA and evidence found at Quattlemoc's home that matched Robert as well. So in my opinion, he was guilty. But I say that to say, I wonder if Robert realized that, you know, Quattlemoc used to work there, and he realized that maybe some of the victims knew Quattlemoc and could name them as the shooters. Obviously, they didn't get away with it because the same night, a few hours later, they were caught and arrested and charged with capital murder. I do want to reiterate that Tamika Collins was not Quattlemoc's ex. I don't know who his ex was that worked at Popeyes, but it was not Tamika. I do think it's very sad. I do think that I do wonder what happened with Quattlemoc, because, you know, I guess he had nothing to lose in his mind. He was already there for life without parole for the massacre, and he snapped, and now he's on death row. He got the sentence that his co-conspirator had got years before, and now he's the one on death row for a totally different crime. And yeah, it's just really crazy, and it's all sad. And I can't say that people who grew up with a, you know, rough background commit crimes, because I don't think that's fair. Because I think they could have done something else with their lives. You know, I wish they had more, I guess, role models to help them out. I don't know. I'm not justifying their actions, but I feel like if they had a little bit more, a better influence, they would have been better off in life. I don't know that, but I think that for me personally, but it's just all sad. And I do hope that Brian Archer is okay. Luckily he survived, but I did read that he's had some issues since the shooting as far as physical and mental abilities. And I do hope that he's doing okay as of 2025. And that's it. Thank you for tuning in to this brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And I hope you found this episode interesting. If you liked what you heard and haven't done so, please leave a rating and or review if you can, wherever you listen to podcasts. As I mentioned previously, I do write some articles on Medium.com, and I will add a link to my page in the notes. I hope to have a new story released this weekend as well. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you soon for a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time.